And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Megan Rapinoe is, as my late friend Harold Washington would say, sui generis, one of a kind. A luminescent star and leader of the world champion U.S. women's soccer team, she's increasingly used her platform as a global sports icon to speak out for marginalized people and progressive causes. Now, I don't often say this, but I really was blown away, not just by her story, which is pretty remarkable, but by her candor, her depth, and this disarming genuineness, which you will hear. Before we begin, though, one note. Megan is leading a legal battle for pay equity in U.S. soccer, which we discuss here, but on Friday, a day after we spoke, the women players suffered a legal setback when a federal court judge threw out large portions of their suit. They immediately promised an appeal. Now, here's my conversation with Megan Rapinoe. Hey, Megan. Good to be with you. Good to see you. I'm seeing you in a whole different way, actually, because your signature blonde hair is not blonde. I guess that is a reflection of the times in which we find ourselves.
This is COVID grow out, I'll say. And I'm scared to death to do anything by myself for fear that I might just burn it all off and be left bald, so I'm rocking with natural, I guess.
You're also like you would have been preparing right now. You'd be in the final throes of preparing for the Olympics.
Yeah.
That is not happening. First of all, how are you spending your time? And then, what does it mean to have the Olympics postponed for you and the other athletes?
Oh, how am I spending my time? I've actually find myself quite busy doing a lot of Zooms and IG lives and podcasts. Turns out I like being social, and I think I like kind of staying in the mix. I actually feel more rested because I'm not traveling and flying all over the country doing appearances and playing and all that. So found time to still do quite a bit of public stuff, but just trying to keep in shape as well. I mean, there's no way to train at the level you need to be ready. So just trying to kind of stay at a baseline and just sort of be thankful for where I am. There's a lot of people who are in, terrible conditions, and just trying to, obey the stay-at-home orders and make the best of it while I can. And in terms of the Olympics, I mean, obviously my girlfriend Sue and I both are in the same position. It's devastating in this way. This is an opportunity sometimes people only get once in their lifetime. There undoubtedly will be people next year, if the Olympic happens, that they wouldn't have been there, and they might have been there this year, or new people might come. So it's very uncertain for us. But at the same time, I just can't help but feel it's completely pales in comparison to the current moment and what we're in and how important this moment is. So in a way, I'm kind of like, well, yeah, of course we're not going to play the Olympics. And, frankly, I think the Olympics are in doubt next year, but, just thankful we're safe and happy and healthy.
Even next year, huh?
I mean, I don't know, obviously, we don't know. Hopefully we'll, stumble upon a drug therapy or, we'll have a record time in vaccine, but the more I think about it logistically, just bringing everybody together like that with the absence of drug therapies or anything like that just seems difficult, but, very hopeful still. But, yeah, it'll be, I guess we'll see. I don't want to be in the prediction business, but we'll see.
I don't want to be indelicate about raising this, but you've had a long and very celebrated career, and you're at an age where people begin winding their careers down. You've said you're nowhere near that point, but there's that element, is there, too. You mentioned your girlfriend, Sue, sort of casually. She's a world-class future Hall of Fame basketball player, and
yeah,
so a major athlete, also at the end of her playing career. What does a time lost mean?
That's something I think we're sort of grappling with right now, and as this pandemic unfolds and things pop into our head, we're trying to figure out what it all means. In the beginning, before the Olympics were postponed, it was like, we were very early on, like, of course it's going to be canceled. And what does that mean? Is it going to be postponed? So that was a little difficult. And then I think we've kind of recently started thinking, well, wow, it's only, you know, potentially a year away. Are we going to be ready by then? I mean, it's just so unknown. That's not a comfortable feeling. As an athlete, you try to, you know, control everything that you can. And certainly you want to be able to go out the way that you want to and not sort of be, I guess, pushed out by a pandemic. But it's a very strange time for an athlete. Our whole lives in many regards and many aspects are so planned out for so long. Even working out right now, I'm like, I need to work out because I need to stay fit. But I'm like, why? We're not playing this summer, most likely. But I'm like, but what if we do? So it's really strange to not have that sort of structure around it. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think if it happens that, you know, we can't play sports for the rest of this year or a number of years or whatever it may be, you know, the situation will be what it is. And I think we'll be at peace with that. But I think we're definitely both hoping to be able to play in this Olympics, and will, you know, likely be the last Olympics for both of us. Maybe not for me. I might try to hang on, but likely.
You know, the you mentioned that you've discovered you're really social, which is a really weird thing. I mean, I think we're all figuring this out. So we're all socializing in these little boxes on Zoom.
Yeah.
And yet it does draw you, you know, people I haven't heard from in a long time say, hey, let's have a Zoom cocktail. Let's have a beer on Zoom. And people are, but I'll tell you one thing that is hard when you're stuck at home, if you're a sports freak, as I am and many people are, is no games. And we don't know, in terms of professional sports, including professional women's soccer, when that is going to happen. And that's a whole different set of issues, because you got a bunch of players who, and we'll talk more about pay later on, but who don't get paid very much. The clubs themselves operate on margins. So that's a big uncertainty as well, as when teams are going to play in and what it's going to look like.
Very uncertain. It's, you know, for all athletes, of course, it's difficult. But, you know, if you're talking about an NBA player versus, you know, a WNBA player or an MLS player even versus an NWSL player, the financial situations and realities are much different for both the structure of the league and each club and then down onto the player. As of right now, I think all of the non-national team players in the NWSL are being paid their salary. They had just started preseason when this hit, so they were protected in that sense. The national team is still playing, but without, you know, any games or opportunity for bonus or playing, you know, the reality is a little bit different. I think it's, you know, unfortunately, we're going to be hit really hard. We don't have the reserves that the NBA has. I mean, the NBA is talking about, you know, I think they instituted the force majeure on their players, which takes 20 or 25% of their salary. Well, you know, if you're making $50 million, it's really, if you're making $1 million, you're still fine. So yeah. I'm concerned about that for sure. I'm not really sure what, as we get deeper into the summer and, you know, are we going to have a season or not? I'm not really sure about the, you know, financial future of the leagues. Hopefully we can ride this out and, you know, be able to come back strong next year or whenever we're able to. But it's definitely a big worry for the female leagues around the country and the world, frankly.
Yeah. No, there's nothing but uncertainty about all of this. And that is really uncomfortable, but most uncomfortable if your livelihood has been lost or is in jeopardy. I want to talk to you about your amazing story, your life journey from Redding, California. Tell me about growing up in your small town in Northern California.
You know what? It's funny. I never thought about it ever until, you know, I left it and out of college and even quite a bit out of college. It seemed, you know, totally normal to me. And I think by all, you know, standards is pretty normal. Grew up in a great family. I'm a twin and we're the youngest of six kids. So there was plenty happening in the household. You know, both my parents, blue collar workers, my dad works in construction, my mom's a waitress. You know, they grew up, you know, driving us all over the North State and in California, just in general, playing soccer. But I didn't really realize until after, and I became, you know, much more liberal and realized, oh, I didn't grow up in a blue area or in a blue family per se, but, you know, all the same sort of values of, you know, treating one another fairly and taking care of one another and sort of shirt off your back kind of values. That's how I grew up. So I think it's, I don't know if people don't know my whole story and they just kind of look at me and think, you know, I probably grew up in like a hippie commune in San Francisco or something. But turns out I grew up, you know, in Trump country.
Yeah. Well, yeah, actually, I think your town voted overwhelmingly for him.
Overwhelmingly, yes. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. You mentioned that your folks drove you all over Northern California. You played basketball. You were on the track team. You did not play soccer in high school. You played for a club that was from the Bay Area, 2 hours from where you lived. Your mom, who worked 6 days a week, would spend her days off taking you and your sister to play soccer. First of all, why did you do that? Why didn't you play for your school? Why did you join this club? And secondly, how hard was it for you as someone who wasn't affluent, who didn't come from a well-to-do family, which probably wasn't the norm on the club team that you played on?
Yeah, I mean, we ended up going to Sacramento and playing on that team out of Elk Grove because there was no, you know, competitive team at that level in our town. So earlier on when we were maybe 10 and 11, there was, you know, different teams that came about and we played competitively, which allowed us to go and be seen in Sacramento and beyond. But kind of once everyone was getting into high school, you know, the other players on the team weren't going to continue on playing soccer. So that's why we, you know, eventually went and played in Sacramento. It was really the only option to play at the highest level for us. And then it's interesting. It's almost like, you know, we lived in Reading and, you know, coming out of Reading, I always claim it. And we have this, like, you know, soccer star coming out of Reading, but we never really played there very often. And in high school, we wanted to play basketball, and soccer and basketball were in the same season, which happened to be the winter season. So I was like, I can either play outside in the rain, in the cold all the time, or maybe I'll just take a break and keep myself balanced. And, you know, we wanted to play basketball. We love it still to this day. We both love it. So that was kind of the choice there to get out and do a little something different.
Your brother, Brian, it was 5 years older than you, and you've credited him with introducing you to soccer. You and your sister Rachel to soccer, mm-hmm. But his life took a different turn than yours, and that's obviously been impactful on you. What happened with him?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I think what happens with, you know, probably 99% of people that get mixed up with drugs or opioids eventually, and heroin eventually. I think he was, you know, a popular kid in school. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't withdrawn or depressed or anything. He was very social, and I think it started off as a social thing for him, but, you know, quickly, probably whereas most kids, you know, try it through school, whatever, he got caught at school with drugs and with paraphernalia, so immediately sort of put into the system, and then from there, he just, you know, kept using drugs and kept getting caught, and, you know, eventually out of juvenile and into county and then into the state prisons and then eventually into federal prisons. And really a lifelong struggle.
What about for you? He was a role model for you.
Yeah, no, it was very, very difficult at that time. I think, you know, I think he first got in trouble when I was 10 years old. So he was 15 years old. Not really understanding quite what totally was going on, but my parents always told us in very frank terms what was happening. So I'm very thankful for that. It was never something that was kind of kept secret. I mean, it was so hard to, you know, to not only see your brother who you look up to and still to this day, I, you know, love him so much and you know, I'm so thankful that we had, you know, the relationship that we had and that we still have. But going through that as such a young kid and seeing your parents upset and then seeing him in and out of prison and going through all the sort of high school years of being angry with him and pissed at him. Why can't you just, you know, stop, or you're hurting us? And then, you know, understanding more about addiction and, you know, particularly, you know, opioid addiction and heroin addiction, how difficult that is and, you know, how the disease just grabs you. And then later in life, understanding more so the criminal justice system, all that. And now it's like,
did he get treatment? Did he have the opportunity for treatment?
I mean, there was bouts of treatment, yeah, in different in different areas or different stints that he had. But it was more so on the context of, you know, do this and then you won't go to prison. But it's, you know, that's not really, the most effective way, I don't think, to keep people from using drugs is threatening them to go to prison or to send them to prison for long periods of time, which I actually feel like, you know, once he was in prison, he got caught up in a lot of other things that really shaped the rest of his life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you've been outspoken lately. This is obviously, this debate has come to the fore. We also have this tragedy right now of people who are in prison who don't necessarily have to be in prison, who are now more exposed to the COVID-19 virus. But you've been outspoken on this prison reform issue, obviously informed by his experience. Had he been diverted to therapy and treatment rather than prison, his life might have taken a different path.
I believe it would have. Yeah, I really do. I mean, someone who's 15, 16 years old, even into his early 20s, to have his route instead of go through intense, you know, therapy, and maybe that means a trade school, but therapy along the way and counseling and help, to be thrown into, you know, a federal prison system, to be, you know, in Susanville or Pelican Bay or whatever it may be, for really the problem at the root of it is drugs. It just makes no sense to me. First of all, you know, our streets are being filled to the max with pills. I mean, we're seeing it all now, obviously, with the opioid companies and the prescription drugs, and just how devastating that was and how much knowledge these drug companies had that A, it was addictive, and B, exactly what they were doing. They were pumping, you know, the famous town in, West Virginia that had, 30,000 pills per person or whatever it was. So there's that all happening at the same time. And then, you know, you're putting someone into the federal prison system at such a young age. And when they get out, what kind of job are they supposed to get? You can't get a job if you have a felony. No one wants to hire you. You're, you know, sort of now the gap between the life skills is increasing for you. And so now, you know, it's really difficult. The easiest thing is to, you know, go back into prison. And then that's the people that you know. And you're really just kind of in this loop that is really difficult to get out. You know, our prison systems are packed full of people who really just have drug issues. They're not violent criminals. And it's just, yeah, it's obviously a very complicated issue. We go on for hours about it. But it's just so sad to see how many people have been caught up in it. And I think a lot of people's, you know, perception of it is that, you know, drug addicts are bad people and that, you know, bad people do bad things. And it's just, that's just not the reality of it at all.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. You were in the crowd in 1999, the women's national team beat Brazil in the World Cup semifinal at Stanford in your neck of the woods. When you were sitting there watching Mia Hamm and the rest of that team, did you say to yourself, I'm going to be that person someday?
I think I probably thought, I really want to be that person. I'm not sure I quite understood the path or that there was a path. I'm not sure there totally was a path for me then. I think I was, 13 or 14. But I definitely remember being like, this is the most incredible live thing I've ever been to. And just seeing, you know, not only the passion on the field, but with all of the spectators and wondering, I think, to myself, is this something, I certainly want to do it. This looks like the most amazing performance I could ever be a part of. But is there a way forward to that, I think? I was probably still a little shy to even be thinking that at that point.
Now, your sister was a player too. Your twins. She never achieved exactly the same level of success as you did. She did well. You guys went to college together and so on. Was that ever a source of tension between the two of you?
You know, I don't feel like it really was. She was far better at basically everything than me until like midway through junior year in high school. And then it kind of like switched a little bit, but we both, you know, went and played soccer at the University of Portland on a full ride scholarship. So we were both accomplished in our own right. But I think because, you know, we were, you know, she was so much better for all those years. And then we kind of like evened out and, you know, I pulled ahead after college. It was never this competitiveness against each other. I think we've always been each other's biggest fans and wanting the best for each other. And I think it was clear that my passion really was in sports and in soccer, and her passion wasn't quite there for it like it was with mine.
One of the things that happened at the University of Portland is you came out. You both came out.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about that, and tell me about the experience of going back and talking to your folks about that.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting because we actually went to school in different semesters. I took the first semester off, so it would have been like the fall semester, to play in a youth world championship. So Rach went ahead to college. I got there in the January semester. And so we both kind of came to it on our own, and then sort of figured out that it was happening at the same time and kind of talked about it. I think in an effort to make it better for Rachel, but in hindsight, this probably wasn't my place, I actually outed both Rachel and I at the same time to my mom. And she was like, "That is not your thing to tell." And I was like, "I know, but, you know, I thought we could just maybe bring it all together." I thought they were like, you know, going to be totally fine about it. Took them a little bit to adjust, but overall, they're fine now.
It was, I read that you talked a little bit about that conversation, and you told your mom this is an adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
You used the word grieving in there. That was interesting to me that you were thinking about how she would process all of this. And how did she receive that when you said that?
I think that might have come a little bit later. My mom and I are very similar. We're both very fiery. So in the moment, I think I was like, well, first of all, shocked that she didn't already know. I was like, this cannot be coming as a surprise to you. Because when I first figured out, I was like, oh my God, I'm embarrassed that it took me this long. But then I think, you know, as the months kind of, you know, traveled on, I began to understand that, you know, as a parent, you would have your hopes and your dreams for your children. It doesn't mean that you can't have those, but the picture will change a little bit. And so I think in the beginning, I was like, you're gonna, you know, be on board with this, or like hell or high water, you're out of here. And then I kind of realized, like, okay, like, what are we talking about here? There has to be, you know, some grace, not all the grace. I think that, you know, parents sometimes, you know, they want to, I don't know, they sort of is like, what does this have to do with me, or how did I fail you? And it's like, it's actually not about you at all. So I think just giving that time to sort of understand the process and come to terms with it, while still sort of pushing on some issues at the same time, is the right way to go.
The other thing that happened at Portland is you got hurt a lot.
Yeah.
You blew out your knee not once, but twice.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a long, long convalescence. And how'd you keep from getting discouraged? How'd you keep from saying, well, maybe this isn't going to happen for me?
Yeah, I had to have a big dose of humility for myself. I think I went in as a freshman, you know, played well as a freshman. I thought, oh, wow, I'm pretty good. I'm feeling pretty good about myself here. And then it happened, I think, you know, 5 or 10 games into my sophomore year. So basically all my sophomore year and junior year were out. So I think with the first one, you know, I was like, I'm going to get back as soon as possible, and this isn't going to keep me down, and, you know, I'm going to do things my way, yada, yada. And then the second one hit, and I was like, oh, okay, yep, I'm not in charge here. So I just kind of need to, you know, give myself over to the process. And throughout it all, I never doubted my love for soccer or that I wanted to come back to it. And so I think through that, I realized, like, just be patient and give yourself the time you need to heal, because you can't speed it up. Like, you can't speed up the healing process. You can only, you know, work with it and sort of react to it. But the love and the passion was always there. I mean, it was difficult not being able to do, you know, what I was thinking I'm going to college for, obviously getting my education, but really I was focused on the soccer. I think it tested me in those moments, but it also made me so grateful for what I had and the opportunity that I had. And then once I was able to get back on the field with that sort of extra sense of humility and like this could be taken away at any moment, I feel like it made me a better person and a better player.
You know, in that freshman year, I think you guys won the championship.
Mm-hmm.
And you were undefeated, and you were a big part of that. And, you know, look, it's no secret that everywhere you go, your teams have done very well. Now, either you're very lucky
yeah.
or you're very good. You're obviously a gifted athlete. There are a lot of great athletes, though, but there is an element that separates sort of the people who perform at the highest level that seem more mental than physical. And I'm wondering if you've given thought to that and what it is about your makeup that has contributed so much to your success.
Yeah, a lot, especially as I've gotten older, I think, as the, you know, you're not as spry as you once as you once were.
I've learned that, yes.
Yeah, you're just starting to learn that. You know, it is the mental aspect that I think sets people apart. I mean, of course, once you get to the very highest level, everyone is extremely gifted. I mean, it's not, you don't just work your way to the highest level. You have to be, you know, born with some sort of God-given, you know, talent. That sort of puts you there. But then once you're there and everyone is there, it takes a certain, and it's not cockiness, and it's not arrogance, but it takes a certain amount of self-assuredness because everybody is exceptional. And almost in the sense of like, other people are going to be able to do things that you can't do at the highest level. But in turn, you're the same. You can do things that other people can't do either. So it's kind of the combination of being absolutely sure of yourself and absolutely sure of your teammates at the same time. I think if you can get that balance right, you know, especially in a team sport, like we play so many players on the field at one time and, you know, so much, you know, synchronization needs to happen. I think if you can equally trust yourself and trust your teammates and trust in your ability and their ability, then you really get to the special thing that makes teams great. Because you can have all the greatest players that you want, but if they're not working together as a team, you never get to that higher level of play or being as a group.
You know, ESPN is running this series about the Bulls, which
phenomenal.
Is close to my heart because I'm a Chicagoan. And I was there for those 13 years of Michael Jordan. And it is absolutely true that when he was on the court, you just thought, well, we're not going to lose. He won't let us lose. Mm-hmm. And he, in turn, has said, well, you know, when the game is on the line, it kind of slows down for me and I see things really well. And it seems to me there's a difference between all the players are great, but the player who sort of wants to take control of the game at the time, you know, Bill Walton, I did a podcast with him, which was a trip and a half, but he said, hey, I loved it. That was fun. When the game was on the line, he said, for me, that was fun. For a lot of guys in basketball or gals, there's a, hey, don't pass to me right now. You know, I don't necessarily want to take that shot. You seem to have that quality. You've always played well in the big games.
I mean, I love the big games. I would trade all of the practice and everything and put me in like the most pressure cooker moment every time. And it's not really about the pressure. I feel like it's all kind of a grand performance, and I see myself in a lot of ways as an entertainer and as a performer in this way. And so you go out and you have the crowd is involved and the pressure is involved and the other team is involved and your team is involved and maybe there's a championship on the line or whatever. And I like all of those elements kind of interplaying with each other. I think watching the documentary, you see that with Michael as well. He liked it all. He wanted it, all of those moments. And it was like, you know, I think he had probably gone through in his mind, if I miss the shot, you know, I miss it. I'll take the next one. But sort of being comfortable with that failure gives you the opportunity to succeed.
You haven't failed very much. You did. You've been on losing teams, the Olympic team. You lost, or the World Cup team, I guess I should say. How do you process that, losing?
I mean, I feel like I'm very realistic with it. Almost how I approach injuries. Like, you know, if I get injured, it's, you know, it's not really much I can control. I can go back and sort of look at, you know, kind of an autopsy of what happened and get stronger in certain areas and hopefully prevent it. But, I mean, if you play the game long enough, you know, and hopefully you're successful enough, you get in enough of those positions, you would be extremely lucky to win them all. And sometimes the other team just honestly plays better. I look back at, you know, Japan winning the World Cup in 2011. And then you take a bigger look at it, the whole story, the tsunami had hit the year before, a sort of national rallying cry that they had, and you know, them coming back and winning in the late moments. It's still heartbreaking. I still feel like we should have won that. But I don't know, it's kind of like, what are you going to do? Like, you can't go back. You're not going to rewind history. So I try to take, you know, all of the good with the losses and just think like, wow, I've had an opportunity to play in 3 straight World Cup finals. And I've played, you know, I've never won an NWSL championship, but I've played in 2 finals and we had 2 amazing seasons. And, you know, just try to learn from all of that. But it's like, it's all kind of part of it. I don't get too stuck on the losses. I feel that I'm very fortunate to be able to play it on all these championship teams.
You say you think of it as entertaining. You've talked about this. Your flamboyance is kind of a signature. I mean, not very many people have a signature crowd move named after them, like the Rapino. As you do, and you've said that people react differently to women athletes who are flamboyant, who play to the crowd, than they do to male athletes who do the same.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, we look back at, Michael Jordan is a perfect example. I feel like this is probably where I get a lot of it. I grew up glued to the screen watching the Bulls. I had, you know, a life-size cutout and all these posters of Jordan. And he had this insane ability to, like, dagger your heart and then, like, do one of these, you know, or, like, yeah, give you a wink or tell you he's going to whoop your ass and then, like, do it with this sort of smile. And I just feel like men have the space to have multiple things happening at one time, whereas I think women don't always have that space. So you can be a killer, you can be a shit talker, and you can have a smirk, and you can be an entertainer, and you can be great, and you can say it. It's like all those things are possible with men, whereas I feel like women, it's a little bit more like, okay, she's going to work really hard and we're going to inspire the next generation. It's all about inspiring the next generation and being a role model and all those things. But it's also like, I'm also great at what I do. And I also want to have fun. And I also, you know, want to be able to poke jabs and, you know, entertain the media and sort of have the whole circus going on. I feel like we need to allow our women more space to just be themselves and make it a little bit more entertaining.
Yeah, man, and I got to tell you, the people who are watching enjoy watching you have fun. I mean, it's fun to watch a great athlete have fun.
Yeah.
You, as you point out, you lost the World Cup in 2011 to Japan. You came back and you had a chance to avenge that loss in the Olympics in 2012. Before those Olympics, you made the decision that you were going to come out publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that and how that impacted on you.
It honestly just started to feel a little weird that I wasn't out, you know, out in my normal life, friends and family. But it was kind of one of those things like, are you omitting things, or are you changing your answers? Are you, you know, using certain pronouns to avoid things? And that it just started to feel disingenuous for me. So there was that part of it personally. And then, you know, I think like, you know, the gay rights argument and movement was more so starting on, you know, legalizing marriage, and that had become sort of more popular and broad topic. I think I was sort of dipping my toe more so into politics and getting involved in that. And it just felt like this is the right time. And I also think people were like, oh, you know, you did it right before the Olympics to like make a splash. I'm like, well, yeah, I'm not going to do it in the you know, back page of a nothing newspaper where nobody's going to see it. What's the point of that? You know, so it's kind of like, yeah, I do want to make an impact. Even this year when people say, oh, you're leveraging the moment, I'm like, hell yeah, I'm leveraging the moment. What's the whole point of everything unless everybody's seeing it?
Right.
So it was kind of one of those things. It just felt like the right time, and I felt like it was a you know, the right step for me to come out and say, especially leading into the Olympics, which is supposed to be all about unity and, you know, everyone competing at their best. And I just feel like if I'm not competing as my full self, then there's something missing.
How, what kind of reaction did you get from particularly young people, gay, young women? And then I want to talk to you about men and men athletes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, David, so positive to this day. I mean, it's been, you know, a number of years, and still to this day, kids come up to me, you know, parents come up to me, people my age, people much older than me, you know, just saying how impactful it was on their life, just to have more people in different sectors of our society and of our culture that are not only out in saying it, but then not having it be the only only thing that's talked about. It's like, yes, I am a gay professional athlete, but I think I've gotten to the point now. You don't always have to put gay in there, but it's very clear that I am gay, and it's sort of in the room all the time, so then it breaks down stereotypes and it becomes more normalized. So I think, you know, that's been sort of the gift that has kept on giving this whole time, is just realizing how important it is. Even just if one person comes out, you might just reach that one person. And for me, that just keeps happening. It's truly amazing.
So I mentioned male athletes. You know that as a statistical fact, that there are a lot of gay men in athletics, mm-hmm. as there are everywhere else. And yet you see very few coming out.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if male athletes have actually come to you at all to talk to you about that.
Oh, not that I can think of that aren't out yet. It's a very complicated issue. I think a lot of people focus on the fact that no male athletes are out, and they say, you know, they need to come forward and show that bravery. But for me, I think that the organizations and the teams and the leagues and, you know, the sort of structures around it clearly aren't making it so that those players feel safe. You know, it's like Michael Sam came out in the NFL and he just didn't have a team anymore. Now, we can debate the merits of whether he was good enough to play, but I think that sends a pretty strong signal to other players. And whether that's, you know, not just locker room talk, but from an institutional standpoint of some of these teams, I don't think they're really going above and beyond to make it clear to not only the players, but to the media and the staff and all of the players in the locker room and everyone in the organization, that you will be safe and you will be protected and we will stand with you when you do this. Not like, okay, when you come out, now we'll show the resources. I think it sort of needs to be signaled prior to that. And I think just the stereotype with gay men and with, you know, athletics, it's like if you're an athlete and you're a man, you're macho. If you're gay and you're a man, you're somehow feminine. I mean, I can't believe that we're still feeling that way, because it's. I think we're past that, but
or should be. Yeah.
Or should be. A lot of these, you know, athletes, they feel it. They can't take the risk. You know, they have their financial future and their careers hanging in the balance, and maybe they just feel more comfortable, unfortunately, staying in the closet. It's very sad.
You spent a couple of years playing in France. The professional league folded after the Olympics in 2012. You didn't have a team to come back to. You got an offer from the best team in France. You spent a couple of years living there. Did that give you any kind of a different perspective on America, on life? How formative were those years that you spent there?
Very. I loved my time in France. I think, interestingly, I thought, you know, I'm thinking France, and it's like so open and, you know, so like free-loving. I actually found that it was much more conservative than I thought. And maybe that was more in the sports world. But they thought I was like the craziest thing that had ever happened. I don't know if it's like, they sort of have this like collective self-conscious. I talk about this all the time. If they would just like let loose a little bit more. Then, and maybe it's in the context of sports, but I feel like if you guys could just loosen up a little bit, then like everything would be a little bit better. But yeah, there was a sort of, and I didn't speak French very well. I wasn't like fluent or anything. I mean, I would try. I would, you know, speak French in a store or whatever and get answered back in English. And I was kind of like, well, that's fine. I tried. You appreciated it. I know you speak English. So it was an interesting time. It got a little lonely towards the end. I spent, I think a year and a half there. So got a little lonely towards the end. So it was nice to be able to come home. But living in another country, I would recommend to everyone, if you have the opportunity, just to be out of your comfort zone that much, that often. You can't help but grow up a little bit.
And did you get a sense of how the world sees America when you were over there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, they think we're loud and they think we're sort of arrogant, and I was like, well, you're not totally wrong, but I think there's much more permission to be yourself here and to be different here. I think that we, you know, allow ourselves that freedom a little bit more. I mean, I think a lot of the stereotypes, too, are wrong. You know, it's just what they see on TV, you know, much like what we see on TV. So I think that sort of speaks to being able to live in a different place or go to a different place, see other people, when it's like there's really no right or wrong for the most part. It's just, you know, different cultures and what people are comfortable with, and anything we see as different is just sort of automatically kind of brushed up against.
We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the Axe Files. So a lot of things happened in 2016. You went to the Olympics. You met Sue. You blew out a knee in that period again, this time the right one. And speaking of knees, you also, in the fall of that year, took one. And you took one because of what Colin Kaepernick had done. That was kind of a transformative experience. I mean, that you said you were dipping your toe into politics and activism. That was a full immersion in politics and activism. And the reaction was not entirely positive on the part of the soccer authorities and so on. Tell me about that period, because it sounds as if you were sort of blackballed for making the stand that you made.
I mean, it was a period in time that completely changed my life for the better, in my opinion, one I'm so thankful for. I mean, Colin Kaepernick completely changed my life, Black Lives Matter, just that sort of movement. And I think as an athlete, standing up for yourself, using your platform in that way, there's so many amazing things that come with being in a society, really, that glorifies famous people and athletes and all of that. There's so many positives that come from it. And I feel like I found the balance between all the positives and actually doing something with it. No, it was not looked upon favorably by a lot of people. I mean, I don't know if it was an actual blackball, but I don't think I ever put the jersey on or made a roster again until the rule was made by the board of directors and the president of U.S. Soccer that you had to stand. I mean, sort of immediately their response, I think after it was the night of the first game that I did it for the national team, while playing for the national team, it was, you know, you should feel honored and privileged to, you know, pull on the jersey as if, like, that's the only thing that matters. And I'm like, it's, you know, of course I feel honored and privileged, but part of that is, you know, being able to speak my mind. And also I pull on this jersey for everyone. And I think this flag drapes on certain people different than it drapes on other people. So I think, you know, going through that process, and I thought in the moment, it's an opportunity to support Colin, but maybe I can bring another subset of people into the conversation who, you know, maybe wouldn't listen to Colin, but maybe would listen to me. And I'm not sure I had that effect on people. People were very upset and mad, but I think it actually, you know, it did start a conversation in a wider group of people, but I think it also, you know, put a highlight on, you know, some of the criticism that Colin was getting. You know, I think that, you know, saying that he was anti-military or that I was anti-military, anti-America in any way, I think that, you know, a lot of the criticism, you know, they sort of got themselves on that one.
Your hometown didn't react very well to that. Your mom has worked in the same place for years and years and years. They had a bunch of your sports memorabilia up. They took your memorabilia down.
Yeah, they did.
So, I mean, as we pointed out, at that very moment, they were going 65% for Trump. He was the guy who really pushed this issue. How did you resolve this with your folks?
A lot of conversations around this. And I you know, am so thankful for the relationship that we have, because, you know, and being able to be so open with each other, because it did put a lot on them. You know, I wasn't in Reading having to, you know, defend myself or to defend my actions or to even be able to speak about them. You know, it was my mom who was just trying to go about doing her job, and people coming into the restaurant mad or with snarky comments or being rude, you know, at some of the nicer points. So I feel like it did open a lot of people's eyes up to a different part of the conversation, and even just being willing to have this conversation, because now someone that they know and love and who has grown up around them and who's been, you know, a staple in their workplace or in their family, you know, she's saying these things, okay, maybe we trust her a little bit more, so how can we start to understand this a little bit better? And you know, we don't agree on everything. I still think they probably wish I could have found a different way to do it, but there is no different way. If I would have done something different, it would have, you know, people would have been upset about that as well. So I think just the ability to have that conversation.
You said your dad said something that I found really moving, which is that he's a veteran and that he fought for the right of Americans to express themselves, which is, you know, to my view, exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, something that I still feel strongly, you know, to this day, it was never obviously an anti-military, but we have to give people the option and the ability and to safeguard them when they want to speak their mind, especially if they're, you know, speaking their mind for a subset of people who have historically been, you know, discriminated against. And I don't think anyone can deny, you know, the racial injustice and, you know, disparities that have been put on people in this country. So
we're seeing some of them in real time right now.
We are, very much.
In terms of who has been most deeply affected by COVID. Yeah,
yeah, it's really sad. And I think for people to understand the bigger picture, it's not that, you know, your life has been easy and this person's life has been hard. It's not that simple. You know, sometimes two people struggle, but you know, there are certain people that, you know, based on historically in our country and, you know, laws that have been made and everything passed down, that there's no denying that we have a racial issue in this country.
You had a hell of a year last year. You guys won the World Cup. You took in just about every award that one can win in soccer and in professional sports. You were the Sports Illustrated Athlete of the Year, only the fourth time ever that a woman in 66 years won that award. You also, you had a couple of other forays into public debate, and one of them was very personal to women everywhere, and that is the pay equity issue with soccer. This has been bubbling up for years, but you guys filed suit to try and get paid equally for what you do. It was a propitious time because everybody in the world was watching the U.S. women's soccer team, and yet you guys are paid in a very, very disparate way from men. One measure was professional men, $263,000 for 20 exhibition matches a year, women, $99,000. And there are a series of measures like this. And U.S. soccer, in response, issued a really offensive legal brief in which they talked about women being essentially not the physical equal of men and a whole bunch of pejoratives. That must have riled the hell out of you.
It's been riling the hell out of us. I think something interesting about, you know, those horrible comments, that might have been the first time that the public had heard those comments or that we had, you know, seen those comments, you know, directly related to the lawsuit in a legal brief. But if not the exact words, certainly the exact sentiment is what we have been feeling all along. I think it shows up in our paychecks. I think it shows up in our mediations. I think it shows up in our bargaining sessions that we go through and just sort of the general dialogue and discourse that happens between the women's national team and the federation. So to, you know, for them to take what I thought was another big step forward, I'm like, this is, you're actually using this as an argument in the public, like, you know, this is going to be public, you know, people are going to see this, was so disappointing. I mean, this is an organization charged with, you know, the development of soccer in the country for everybody. And so to signal to not only the boys that they are just innately better, but to the girls that they're innately lesser was just, I mean, it was stupid, first of all. You know, if you're trying to win this lawsuit, it was not a good step. And it just, I think, really showed how deep that sentiment goes, that they were willing and comfortable to put that in a public briefing.
And call it indisputable science.
It was just, yeah. It was outrageous, is what it was.
Yeah. So tell me where it is now. The last I saw, you were going to some sort of mediation.
Yeah, so we tried mediation in the fall, last fall. That did not go spectacular. Clearly, we don't have a settlement. We're not going into mediation now. I mean, of course, settlement talks are ongoing always when you're in a lawsuit.
You've asked for $66 million in damages.
Yeah, thereabouts. We feel like, you know, not only the two World Cups, but, you know, years of discrimination, pay discrimination in our wages and contracts. As I've said for a long time, I always continue to say it, they're the only, you know, federation that we can have. We're the only team that they can have. We're going to be tied together forever. So I'm always hopeful that there's a way that we can work through this. But I really do believe that there needs to be a major paradigm shift in how they think about the women's team and how they value the women's team, you know, and how they value the men's team. And
in fairness, the men's team hasn't been very good.
No, they have not been very, they've been successful But yeah, no, on the world stage, they haven't quite performed, I think, the way they want to. But I think in order to honestly have the paradigm shift that we need, there needs to be a clearing of the house. I don't think that you can have all, you know, a lot of the same people that have overseen a lot of these decisions and been there for a long time, you know, unless they all sort of have a come to Jesus moment.
You also made some news before the World Cup when you were asked whether you would go to the White House if you won the World Cup. And you said, I'm not going to the fucking White House. Needless to say, that got some attention.
Got picked up.
It did, including by the president himself,
yeah.
Who, despite his, you know, thick skin, felt the need to respond to that. And he said, stop talking and win, which you went out and did. How did your team react when you said that?
You know, it's so interesting. I feel like I still to this day don't have that, like, gut feeling like, oh, I did something wrong. Like, the president just, you know, came at me on Twitter.
That's a big group of people, my friend. You're in a large community.
Yeah, exactly. I got a lot of people with me in that. I mean, I think because, you know, of the lack of seriousness that he takes with the presidency and, you know, with his words, I think everyone was like, oh my gosh, this is insane. Like, the president is coming at you. But I think because I didn't have that, like, sinking feeling, I think the team sort of took the signal from me and it almost sort of brought us together closer. Everyone was like, oh my God, you're taking down the president. This is insane. He's having like a total meltdown on Twitter about you. So it was kind of a funny thing. And then obviously we were, you know, able to go on and win. And then the silence was deafening. I still haven't gotten my invitation.
Yes, I'm sure you're sitting by your mailbox waiting for it. You've also become much more forward-leaning in terms of politics with a kind of capital P. You endorsed Elizabeth Warren for president. Tell me why you endorsed her. And I know you're doing a thing with Vice President Biden, maybe in a few minutes here.
Yeah, right after this.
Tell me about your evolution here.
I mean, I think that's a perfect way to put it. It has been an evolution. I think as I've, you know, sort of waged more into this sort of political landscape, I really enjoy it and I like it. I'm interested in politics. I think that, you know, getting younger people to understand that whether you're engaging with politics or not, it's engaging with you. So you might as well get involved. I mean, we're seeing that firsthand now. How important is not only the president, but, you know, everyone in his cabinet, and we're seeing the governors and the mayors and the local official, everybody, I think, is really starting to understand just how important government is and how I hope people see that we have the ability to shape it. And so I think part of why I'm just interested personally, I want to understand it better, but I also want people my age and people like me who I think tend to say, I don't want to make it political. I'm like, well, that's not even a question. It is political. Whether you walk on the street and, you know, hit a stop sign, or, you know, you don't have health care, whatever it is, I want younger people to understand that it's engaging with you. So, like, how do we make it cool? How do we make it interesting? And I think for me, as someone who has a platform, how do I, you know, engage in it, and how do I at least lend that platform, whether that be a candidate or groups or whatever it is, to get more people involved. And with Elizabeth Warren, I mean, I loved her policies. I thought they were great. I think that she's proven to be very deaf in the political landscape with the Obama administration and all her work on the Consumer Protections Bill and how she looks out for people. I think she has this really sort of genuine, smart, but she's such a bulldog. And I was kind of battling, do I get in early or do I get in late? Because what if you get in and then your candidate doesn't make it, will this happen? But I think the more people are engaged, like, it's okay. It's okay that Elizabeth Warren was my first choice and she's out now. And now I'm going to be, you know, full board with Vice President Joe Biden and, you know, throwing my support, because I think ultimately it's the policies that I'm geeked out about. It's what's actually going to happen and affect people on a day-to-day basis that's going to have the most impact.
You can make a little pitch to Biden for a Warren on the ticket while you're with him today.
I might make a pitch for myself.
Yeah, well, what about what about that?
No, I'm
you're
kidding.
almost of the appropriate age.
Hey, yeah, I know, right?
I got to ask you about that, because I'm sitting here and I'm listening to you, and, you know, I worked on 150 campaigns, and so when I hear someone who is as powerful as you are in expressing yourself and is passionate about bringing about change, It's a natural question. I mean, I know you're going to play until your mid-40s based on what I see, but is that something that you'd ever even consider?
I don't know. I've been asked this a lot lately. I don't know. I will certainly be very involved in politics in whatever way that is. I'm not sure the area I can be most impactful yet. I say this a lot. I think everybody has a responsibility to make the world a better place in whatever way they can do so and be most impactful in. So if you're a lawyer, you should, you know, do pro bono hours. If you're me, you should do, you know, IG lives and Zooms with people. So I think I'm still kind of trying to figure out where exactly I can be most impactful. I feel totally unqualified to be any sort of elected official, even though, you know, 2016 notwithstanding, normally you have to have some sort of, you know, extensive resume. I guess that's sort of out the window, but
I think that's changed.
I think that's changed. Maybe not for the better, but I think that has changed. But yeah, I'm not totally closing the door, but you'll have to be my campaign manager if that happens.
Well, you know what? There are very few people who I would consider that for, but let's talk.
Okay.
Let's talk.
Offline.
Megan Rapinoe, it's so great to be with you and so inspiring to watch you do your thing. And I appreciate your investment in the world, not just in your sport. So thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. This is wonderful. I'll have to come back.
Okay, I hope so. Great to see you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of The Axe Files is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Samantha Neal, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Megan Marcus, and Ashley Lusk. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.